Lecture 15, Therapies, Humanistic, Cognitive, Group.
In this lecture, I'm going to continue the discussion of psychotherapies. You'll recall that this is one of a series of lectures on therapies. After we completed talking about the classifications of mental disorders, we moved on to therapies and talked considerably about physical therapies. And then last lecture, we began talking about psychotherapies and spent most of the time talking about psychoanalysis, a particular type of psychotherapy. But it's not the only type of psychotherapy that exists. There are others. And in fact, today, psychoanalysis is in the minority in terms of the kinds of therapies that are used. The therapies we're going to talk about today fit under classifications of humanistic therapies, and then we're going to talk about cognitive therapies that are based upon the notion that it's inappropriate thought that's causing our problems, and then we're going to talk some about group therapies where more than one person is involved in the therapy. And finally, I'm just going to spend a few minutes talking about the efficacy or outcome studies with respect to therapies and what's found when you do that. So let me begin by talking about the humanistic therapies. Humanistic therapies are based upon valuing the uniqueness of humanness and maximizing each person's potential by stressing the wholeness and their ability to change by choice. Now, this is kind of in direct reaction to psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis, as you recall, is based very much at the unconscious level, where we have all sorts of things that we can't get access to, and we have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out ways of bypassing the censoring mechanism to allow us to approach those unconscious kinds of things, and that you have a therapist who is a doctor and has a lot of power, and you have the patient who doesn't have much power, and it's up to the doctor to directively tell you what your problems are and how you might change. So while, as I described last time, Freud might sit there a long time and listen to free association, in the end he's going to tell the patient what he thinks the problem is and how he thinks the patient ought to solve the problem. Humanistic therapies, on the whole, operate under the assumption that we have within us the ability to solve our own problems, that we ought to be, as humans, vitally involved in changing ourselves, that it's not up to the therapist to do this job for us, and that we can do this at the conscious level. We don't have to spend all this time figuring out what's at the unconscious level. So as we will see, we're starting with an assumption that we can think about these things without delving at the unconscious level, and secondly, that we can affect some change ourselves. And that's kind of a basic assumption as we go through these kinds of therapies. One of the first of the humanistic therapies is non-directive or client-centered therapy, and it's also sometimes derisively called therapy. We'll talk about that in a minute. This was a humanistic therapy that is still used today that was devised by Carl Rogers. And it's based upon the premise, as I was just saying, that the client has within himself or herself the ability to solve the problems. The role of the therapist in this case is to act as a sympathetic sounding board or a mirror to reflect back the client's problems. And here we call it a therapist and a client, which implies sort of a similar power base for these two. The client has a lot of power in this relationship, unlike the doctor-patient relationship in psychoanalysis. So the therapist acts as a sympathetic sounding board, and the therapist gives unconditional regard, positive regard, to the client and is very non-judgmental. That's not hard for therapists to do. Therapists have heard it all, after all. We tend to think that we have these hidden thoughts and things that bother us that we don't think anybody else is thinking about. Well, the therapist, after a while, has heard it all anyhow. And so we'll give positive regard to to the person. I mentioned that it's sometimes called uh-huh therapy because there's a lot of that sort of thing going on in the therapy. Suppose you have a client who comes in and says, gosh, I can never get along with my dad. He's just at me all the time. What do you mean by he's at you all the time, the therapist might say. Well, I can't get anything right with my dad. He's always critical of me. So your dad's critical of you, is that right? Yeah, all the time. I mean, just last night I came in and I was 2 minutes late getting in and my dad was all over me. Uh-huh. And he just wouldn't leave it alone. And then the therapist might say, well, how did that make you feel? Because the therapist wants you to explore your feelings as well as your thoughts about these things. But as you can see, this therapist is just sort of sitting there, listening carefully, saying something that indicates to you that he or she is listening to you, and then saying, it's all right what you're saying as well. I'm not shocked by what you're saying. That's a sort of a normal thing for people to think. Now, if you've never experienced this, you might think that, why would I want to go pay somebody $100 an hour to sit there and go, uh-huh, at me all the time? How can that help me? Well, you might get some feel for this if you think of other points in your life where this might go on. If you've never been to one of these kinds of therapists, other people sometimes do treat us this way. You get on an airplane and you're sitting next to a person who's a stranger. Doesn't know your name, you don't know this person's name. And you may discover, striking up a conversation, that 10 minutes later, you're revealing things about yourself to this person that you wouldn't even tell the people who are closest to you. And why can you do that? Well, confidentiality is built in, much like there is in the therapeutic process. The therapist is trained to maintain complete confidentiality. The worst thing that therapist could do is turn around and say, you know what my patient told me today? The therapist isn't going to do that. And the person sitting next to you isn't going to do that because you're never going to see this person again. So there's no way that this person can violate your confidentiality unless you tell them a lot more about yourself. And the person sitting next to you may give you positive regard as well, mainly because it's a lot more work to give somebody negative regard in that situation. It's easier to nod your head and say, oh, well, that's all right. I can see how you feel about that. Or maybe it's not the person next to you in the plane. Maybe it's a bartender or somebody else whose job is sort of to make people feel good all the time. And again, that person can maintain confidentiality. It's not as good as a therapist, of course, because the therapist is trained and you are sure that confidentiality is going to be maintained, and you are sure that you're going to get positive regard from the therapist in this setting. But that gives you sort of an idea of how this might work. Abraham Maslow coined the term self-actualization, and that's sometimes used in this kind of therapy to describe what achieving full potential means. We're going to talk about self-actualization in a subsequent lecture. But what it basically means is being all that you can be. And the notion is here that everybody has the potential to be all that they can be, to be self-actualized. But the problem is that other people constrain us in the way they treat us. And so other people are judgmental about our behavior. And they reduce our assessment of our own self-worth by doing this. And so the part of the reason for having therapy is to prop that back up so we realize that we do have the potential to achieve self-actualization. So that's basically what goes on in this kind of therapy, is that the therapist reflects back the client's emotions and thoughts in a very accepting way, and this helps the client develop positive self-concept. A second kind of humanistic therapy is existential therapy. In existential therapy, because of the term existential, you probably already think it might have something to do with death, and it does. In this case, what the therapist tries to do is help you come to grips with non-existence, that is death, so that clients can take responsibility for their existence, for their life. And in existential therapy, we acknowledge the fact that life is difficult, and that it's necessary for us to confront the kinds of difficult conditions thrown at us by life, and we do this in order to discover the meaning of our existence. Now, there are several problems with this. One is that it tends to be very individualistic. And in this kind of therapy, very often the therapist is quite self-revealing as well as the client, because the therapist has worked through these things for his or her own life and has reached some existential kind of conclusion about this that the therapist often shares with the client. So it's not non-directive in that I'm never going to tell you what to do or even what I think about things, because in this kind of therapy, I might tell you exactly how I've resolved my own existential conflicts in order to try to get you to solve your existential conflicts as well. Another problem with it is that it doesn't work very well with seriously disturbed people. This is sort of a kind of therapy that's designed to enhance your life more than deal with mental disorders when you have them. You wouldn't sit down with a schizophrenic patient and start talking about existential therapy concepts. This patient would have no idea what you're talking about. There's a major break with reality. This kind of therapy is not going to help very much. And it's also difficult to evaluate since it is so individualistic, as I was referring to a minute ago. A second category of therapies are cognitive therapies. The notion with cognitive therapies, the notion is that you're having problems because of irrational thoughts or inappropriate thoughts. And so what you want to do in this kind of therapy is to turn it around and think in a different way. Now here, the therapist again becomes somewhat directive, unlike client-centered or non-directive therapy, because the therapist is going to help you change your thoughts and may have to tell you how to do that kind of thing. The therapist, however, unlike psychoanalysis, is unconcerned with sort of these intra-psychic conflicts at the unconscious level. This therapist thinks that you can do this at the conscious level because the notion is that you can control your thoughts at the conscious level. These are not all derived out of causes coming up from the unconscious level, but in fact you have the ability to control your own thoughts. So the therapist starts talking about problems. The therapist might talk through the particular thoughts. You describe what happened to you yesterday, perhaps, and the therapist might say, well, what did you think about that when that happened? And you describe your thoughts, and in many cases, these thoughts might be inappropriate. That just made me feel worthless. I thought, I can't get anything right, and why am I even trying? The therapist says, well, why did you think that? Let's talk about why you're having those kinds of negative thoughts. Why do you think you're thinking that way? And what can we do to have you think positive thoughts in that situation? So the therapist is trying to help you restructure the way you think and feel about things. Albert Ellis, who does this kind of therapy, is one of the founders of cognitive therapy, has what he calls the ABC theory of personality. And he argues that A, which is a particular environmental event, is B, interpreted and thought about by the client, and it is B rather than A that leads to C, the client's behavior and behavioral problems. So what Ellis is trying to get people to do is not blame the environment for their problem, but blame the way they're thinking about the environment. In a similar way, Aaron Beck, who's another founder of cognitive psychology, argues that what are important are schemas. Schemas are kind of like mental models that you have. The way you represent knowledge is in these schemas. And that's the way you process new information. So what you do is as you are confronted with a new situation in life, you employ one of these schemas or one of these models. And if the model is inappropriate, then you are interpreting new things as if they were like the old things in your life. And so what they try to do with Beck's type of therapy is get people to change the way they think about these things, the models they carry around, in order to have more appropriate models for dealing with things that happen in their lives. Gestalt therapy is another kind of cognitive therapy, and it's based upon the German word meaning the whole, in which the assumption is that there needs to be a unity of mind and body, and that the body can be very important in telling you what's happening in the mind. So a goal of this therapy is to become tuned to your own body's reactions to life events in order to discover what feelings are hidden away. So you're kind of asking your body, well, if you responded this way, what does that mean in terms of the way I feel about things? Maybe I'm having a stomach ache due to nervous anxiety. Your body would say, you must have some negative feelings about what you're doing at the moment. And this then allows you to choose a new course once you understand why your body is giving you these messages. Cognitive therapy is some of the source of the self-help books that are currently popular. Again, the notion is that you have the ability to change your own behavior. And if you have this ability, then you ought to change your behavior. And the books talk about how to do that. Even Dr. Phil, who's currently quite popular, what he does is tell you what to do. He tells you how to change your behavior. There are some people who don't think a lot about Dr. Phil because he does kind of instant one and two sentence analyses of people. So I'm not promoting what he's doing, but in fact he does exemplify what happens in some of Gestalt therapy in terms of people taking responsibility for their own actions. Dwayne Dyer is another one who's published books like Pulling Your Own Strings and Your Erroneous Zones, which talks about people having thoughts that are inappropriate and ways of changing the way they think and the way they feel about things in order to change their lives and allow them to take ownership of the problems that they have. Group therapies is another type of therapy in general. It's less, when I talk about group therapies, it does not imply any particular theoretical orientation because it can have a number of different theoretical orientations. But what happens is that people, rather than talking one-to-one with a therapist, form groups, and you'll have a therapist with a group of anywhere from 6 to 10 clients. Now, there's some obvious economic advantages to this. All 6 or 10 of the clients are paying the therapist for the hour, so one of them doesn't have to pay the full tab. For this reason, insurance companies kind of like this sort of therapy. So there's an economic benefit, but there's some other real benefits as well. For one thing, you do have other people in the group that you can interact with. And if one of your problems is interpersonal reactions with somebody else, and the only person you're generally reacting with on one-on-one is the therapist, this might give you a chance to work on these interpersonal reactions with people other than the therapist and give you a wider variety of experience with other people when you're trying to learn appropriate interpersonal interactions. Another advantage is that the other group members can give you some social support. They can help you work through these problems. And often groups that are formed are based upon having a common kind of problem where the other people are undergoing it. Perhaps there's substance abuse or something like that, and everybody in the room has had some problem with this and maybe at a different stage than where you are in your therapy, and they can help you deal with this problem that you're having. So there is some advantage other than economic advantages. As I say, these groups can be based on all sorts of different kinds of therapeutic approaches, so that doesn't imply a particular approach. There are some drawbacks with groups, however. You'll recall that I mentioned that one of the most important things in psychotherapy is the relationship that you have with the therapist, the rapport you establish with the therapist. And when you're in a group, you have less chance for having sort of the same level of intimacy in this interpersonal relationship with the therapist. And so that may be a problem because we know that one of the best predictors of success in therapy is the kind of rapport you have with the therapist. So that can be a problem, and sometimes also confidentiality can be a problem because these other people in the group are not trained therapists, and so they have not had the kind of training that tells them how unethical it is to break confidentiality. Now, the final thing I want to talk about today has to do with evaluating psychotherapies, what is sometimes called the efficacy of psychotherapies. How do they work? What are the outcomes from psychotherapies? And there are real problems with evaluating psychotherapies. If we think back to the lecture we had on the experimental method, you'll recall some of the problems we had when we were talking about the experimental method. One was operational definitions. At that time, we were trying to operationally define violent TV and operationally define aggression. Well, in this case, the operational definition is an operational definition of therapy. What is therapy, after all? What constitutes therapy? How do we know therapy from non-therapy? Does my talk with the bartender, is that therapy? Or does it require a trained kind of person? Does it have to be psychoanalysis? Can it be non-directive kind of therapy? What exactly are we going to talk about as being therapy and not being therapy? And even once you decide, the individual therapist is often given considerable leeway about what kind of therapy he or she does with a particular client. That's one of the things that people think is sort of the art of therapy. They don't like to do standardized therapy, what's sometimes called manualized therapy, where there's a manual that says exactly how you do this thing, and you have to follow the manual. If you were going to set up an experiment, you would want to have a lot of control over your independent variable so that it's defined the same for everybody. And if you get it allow the therapist to do any kind of therapy they want to, how do you know that you're manipulating the independent variable properly? So that's one problem. A second problem is what we discovered with the experimental method, and that's picking a dependent variable. What do you measure? How do you know when somebody's been helped by psychotherapy? What exactly do you measure to find out? One thing that you could do is ask them whether they've been helped. Well, there are obvious problems with that. In fact, somebody one time did an experiment where they were claiming to have a new kind of therapy, and it was based upon yes and no answers, and that there was supposedly a therapist sitting behind the screen that the client couldn't see, and they were allowed to ask 20 questions with yes or no answers, and right in front of them it would light up saying yes or no as an answer to the thing they asked the therapist. And so they participated in this kind of therapy and then evaluated how good they thought the therapy was. And most of the clients evaluated it as pretty good. They thought they'd been helped by this therapy. What was happening is on the other side of the screen was a person flipping a coin, and if it came up heads, they'd push the yes button, and if it came up tails, they'd push the no button. Is that therapy? Is that a good way to evaluate therapy? One of the more famous efficacy studies was a Consumer Reports kind of article where they had people who had gone to therapists saying whether they thought it had done them much good, very similar to the thing I just talked about. People in general think that therapies do them good. They're biased because very often they've paid for the therapy and they certainly want it to be good for them. But it's not a very good way to find out whether it's doing a good job with them. So what do you do? Do you give them psychological tests to determine whether the therapy was any good? Do you ask the therapist? The therapists are even more invested in this doing some good. After all, they picked this, number one, as their life work, and number two, they spent a lot of time with this client. So if you ask me, did I do a good job for this client, my bias is to say, well, I think I did. If I say I didn't do it, then I perhaps might have to give all the money back to the client that the client just gave me to have the therapy. So you can see that the therapist might be biased too. So we have to have some independent way of measuring a dependent variable to try to find out whether the therapy did any good. Finally, we were concerned about what you do with the other variables, the other circumstances, after you pick your independent variable, and also how you pick the second level of your independent variable. In this case, what's an appropriate control group? If you have a bunch of people who come to see you to get therapy, and they improve, you're kind of proud as a therapist, but you don't really know what would have happened if you hadn't done the therapy with them. And there are some ethical considerations. If you think the therapy that you're doing is doing them some good, there are obvious ethical considerations with saying, I'm not going to give half the people therapy. We're going to make them into a control group. And even the control group, what do you do with the control group? Often people given therapy are in a particular controlled setting where their diet is improved, their environment is improved compared to if you just leave them alone. So what exactly is an appropriate control group? You see the problems with evaluating therapies, and part of the reason so little has been done on evaluating therapies. Way back in 1952, a fellow named Hans Eysenck published a review evaluating the effects of psychotherapy. And at that time, there had been so little done with controlled experimental studies that had an appropriate control group and appropriate things to measure that it was very difficult to do that kind of research. So what he did is he took kind of an overall control group. He found all the people, and he was dealing with psychoneurotics, all the people who had been diagnosed as psychoneurotics who hadn't had any therapy, and then all the people he could find who were diagnosed with the same classification who had had therapy, and he split those up into having had psychoanalysis and those who had eclectic therapy, which is sort of a hodgepodge of other kinds of therapies that he kind of put together. And he discovered that in a two-year period, those who had no therapy improved to the extent of 72%. That's good news, I guess. If you have anxiety disorder, which is what was then called neurosis, in 2 years you're going to get better 72% of the time. But then he wanted to compare, he made that his overall control group, and then he wanted to compare psychoanalysis, and he wanted to compare the eclectic with that. Those who had had psychoanalysis recovered 44% of the time, and those who had had eclectic therapy recovered 64% of the time, to be compared with this sort of overall control group of 72% of the time. Well, people were quite shocked by this. He didn't go so far as to claim that psychotherapy was doing bad things to them, but it certainly would be difficult to argue from his data that it was doing good things for them. So people were shocked, and people just kind of jumped up and down and wrote rebuttal articles, but they didn't have the data either. He then published another article in 1960 and another one in 1969 after there had been a few studies that did actually have control groups, but it was not better at that point either. There really was still no validation of the efficacy of psychotherapy at that point. In the 1970s, there were several articles that looked at psychotherapy, and those found small but fairly inconsistent kinds of effects, positive effects for psychotherapy. But one of the strange things is that they found almost no difference between any of the subtypes of psychotherapy. They all acted about the same. In 1977, there was an important article published using a technique of meta-analysis. And meta-analysis is taking all sorts of studies that have been done, some of them perhaps without appropriate control groups, and combining those statistically so you have a very large group of studies. And this article claimed that there was a moderately large effect of a positive effect of psychotherapy. But there were criticisms of this. Part of the problem is that there are all sorts of different kinds of therapies, and there was not a very good definition of what therapy was in the first place, and what some computer people might argue garbage in, garbage out in terms of statistical analysis. If none of these studies was appropriately controlled and very well done, combining them doesn't give you much more when you put them all together. Again, in the 1980s, there were other articles with mixed results in them, showing positive, some small positive effects, but showing that there wasn't much to distinguish one therapy from another. In recent years, there's been less emphasis on showing the overall effect of psychotherapy and more emphasis on trying to establish practice guidelines that recommend the particular types of therapies that you ought to use for getting the best outcomes with particular disorders. I think this is a positive step because I think we are starting to get to the point where we can diagnose somebody and then employ appropriate therapy for the particular kind of diagnosis, instead of picking our therapies more by the orientation of the therapist than the diagnosis of the disorder. So I think that's a positive trend that we have. So today we've looked at various kinds of therapies that are not psychoanalytic in nature. We look at humanistic, cognitive, and group psychotherapies. And we spent a little bit of time talking about how you establish the efficacy of psychotherapies. Next time, we're going to talk about behavior therapies as an approach to therapy. Thank you.